Back together again, you and I chatting it up Thursday, February 8th, 2024 on Connecticut Today, where we kicked off the show with some thoughts I had on another new poll regarding the 2024 White House race and what the Republican Party's ultimate goals might be. Sacred Heart University political science professor and scholar in residence, Dr. Gary Rose, talked about some of the current trends in state and national politics, while Landmark Legal Foundation attorney and analyst Matt Forries broke down the U.S. Supreme Court arguments regarding Donald Trump's 2024 ballot access issues.
I'm still honestly trying to figure all this out. I am. Every day is a new day. You know that old song, every day is a new day. I mean, I get up and I say, maybe this will be the day that I'm able to figure out. And I remember enough politics for enough years. You know, I'm going to be 63 in a few weeks. God bless, my health is still good. I still feel good. But I'm trying to figure out why people are so confused, especially when it comes to conservatives and the Republican Party in this country. Not so much in this state, because Connecticut is what it is, and the days of electing, I think, my personal opinion, no offense to anyone, but just because of demographics, I think it's going to be a long time before we see a GOP governor or a constitutional officer who's a Republican in this state, but I digress. You know, I'm reading stuff last night and quotes from people in Congress, whether it's the spending bill or the Israel bill or this overtly ridiculous, dumb move to try and impeach Alejandro Mayorkas, which blew up in the Republicans' face. And I'm trying to figure out what people are thinking. Is it an insufficient, you know, blood circulation to the brain? Is it an insufficient amount of what they call their oxygen saturation here? I don't get it. And maybe if you used to be a Republican or conservative or still are, maybe you can help me out at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Let me give you illustration number one here. As to me wondering, what in the hell happened to the party of Ronald Reagan and Dwight Eisenhower and Abraham Lincoln and, you know, the Bush family, whatever. I know it's sinful to say the Bush family. Well, whatever. If you're that way, turn the show off. I can't deal with you. You remember months ago, weeks ago, the big thing on the Republicans' mind, oh, you got to get rid of Kevin McCarthy. Oh, he's awful. You got to get rid of Kevin McCarthy. My God, he worked with Democrats. Get rid of him. And Matt Gaetz and the other morons of that conservative clique, they flushed Kevin McCarthy. They got him out. And how, you tell me how the Republican caucus has been functioning since then. Oh, I don't have to tell you. Listen to what a member of Congress said yesterday. Thomas Massie, Republican congressman, quote, and this is only example one. I've got two juicy examples to start here. Thomas Massie saying, quote, getting rid of Speaker McCarthy has officially turned into an unmitigated disaster. All work on separate spending bills has ceased, wrote Massie on X. He's a Kentucky Republican congressman. Spending reductions have been traded for spending increases. Warrantless spying has been temporarily extended. Our majority has shrunk. But yet, in the middle of this whole thing, nationally, statewide, I mean, I saw on these local conservative social media pages here in Connecticut, good, gotta get that rhino McCarthy out. He's the worst. He worked with Democrats on something. Well, what does somebody say now? A conservative Republican on X, Congressman Massie, I'll read it again, quote, getting rid of Speaker McCarthy has officially turned into an unmitigated disaster. All work on separate spending bills has ceased. Spending reductions have been traded for spending increases. Warrantless spying has been temporarily extended, and our majority has shrunk. It's mind-boggling. It's numbing. It's numbing. I hate to ask this, but I continue to do this. What happened to the Republican Party that I grew up with that wasn't perfect, but at least acted like the adults in the room and didn't pay attention to the crazies in the party, like Matt Gaetz and other people, because they made the most noise? And not to say, you know, not for anything, look at the last three or four cycles. How have a lot of Republican candidates, including ones who got the imprimatur from Donald Trump, how's that worked out? Has anybody noticed the string of losing that's taken over the Republican Party in an election? And I don't care how many times I have to say it, I will say it again. You've got a president in the White House, with all due respect, if you see him out in public, he looks like he's barely functioning. This election coming up, this election cycle, should be a batting practice fastball. It should be on a tee for the Republican Party. But they keep their blinders on. It's like a horse. You know what horse blinders are? So the horse doesn't get spooked and see horses to his or her left or right. They're blinders. Just run them ahead. Hit the whip and run them ahead. Well, sometimes you got to see what's to your left and what's to your right. That's example number one. Let me please show you example number two. When I saw this last night, and I said, whatever, I can't. This makes my fingernails hurt when I read stuff like this. A new Marquette University Law School poll, by the way, in a swing state, shall I mention. A new Marquette Law School poll survey of Wisconsin finds Joe Biden and Donald Trump tied among registered voters, Trump up 1% among likely voters. Okay, that's a statistical dead heat. It's a coin flip. And you may be somebody who says, well, geez, with all the stuff they've put Trump through, those dastardly Democrats, it's pretty good that it's a tie game. And you could say that. All right, I get that. I understand that. But how is it that you read that and then you scroll down here and you say, okay, well, what's the news in that, Paul? Well, I'll tell you. If you scroll down here, it says, among Wisconsin voters, which is a state Donald Trump needs and Republicans need, in a head-to-head matchup between Joe Biden and Republican candidate Nikki Haley. And yes, I'm still going to talk about this. A lot of you people have written me emails saying, why are you so obsessive about Nikki Haley? No, I'm not obsessive about her. I'm obsessive about, I don't know, maybe winning. Winning, is that a bad thing? So in Wisconsin, you've got Trump and Biden basically in a flat-out statistical tie. Not bad for either guy. Okay. Scroll down. In a head-to-head matchup between Joe Biden and Republican candidate Nikki Haley, Haley continues to hold a sizable advantage of 57-41 over Biden among registered voters. Among likely voters, Nikki Haley leads Joe Biden 57-42. So let me explain this to you. Wisconsin's a really important state if the Republicans want to win, right? It's always mentioned as one of those, you know, swing states. There's six or seven or five or swing states, whatever you want to talk about. So you may say, well, look at that. Yeah, Trump needs that state and he's tied with Biden. Well, yeah, he's tied with Biden. But the candidate that for some reason millions of Republicans don't want to vote for is leading Joe Biden in that state by a margin of 57 to 42. It's 15 points. Let's say the poll is bad. Let's say it's not 15 points. Let's say the margin of error was off by half. So let's say instead of 15 points, it's 7.5. It still would be a 7-point lead for one Republican and a maybe 1-point lead for another Republican. Yet, for some reason, the majority of Republican voters, and yes, I'll say it again, Donald Trump may win, I get it. But what has happened to the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, the party of the Bush family, the party of Ronald Reagan, the party of Dwight D. Eisenhower? When you look side by side at two different candidates, one candidate is almost in every poll within the margin of error of the question asked, or a hypothetical matchup with Joe Biden. And the other one, in almost every poll, has a comfortable lead. Yet the Republican Party, for some odd reason, is it, I don't know what it is, is it a virus? Is it an infection? It seems that at least two-thirds of the party does not want to even consider nominating the person who is doing much, 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 much better in the polling. I don't get it. Can somebody, for the love of God in heaven and on God's green earth, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, amen, can somebody explain this to me? Because I don't get it. Is it, I hate to use the word because I have liberal friends of mine who say, the Trump thing is a cult. I hate to use that word, but when you have another candidate in the race that is pulling most Republicans, pulling Democrats, pulling independent voters, and importantly, women, I don't get it. I am stunned. I do not get it. I was staring at the computer last night, looking at this margin, going, please wake me. Please tell me this is a bad dream. All right, we'll get back to open phones later on this hour. And when we do, it'll be at 203-333-9422. Interesting stuff today with the Trump arguments in front of the Supreme Court. And also earlier this week with Governor Ned Lamont's State of the State. So to ponder about that with us, all things local and national and politics, Sacred Heart University political science professor and scholar in residence, Dr. Gary Rose, joins us for his monthly check-in. Gary, good afternoon, sir, and how are you?
Good, Paul. Doing well. Thank you. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, Gary. Thank you, as always, for taking the time. Before we get to the Trump stuff, interesting, Governor Lamont giving his State of the State address yesterday, and I was watching it. We replayed parts of it here on the show, listened to it intently, read the transcript a couple of times, and Gary, about 5 seconds in, he said, the budget's in the black. Live with it. So he certainly is laying down the case to continue these, what have been come to known as these guardrails for spending.
Yeah, yes. And, you know, it really is interesting to listen to the governor and to read what he has to say in the State of the Union about the budget, which is a very large budget, quite frankly, for a small state like this. And yes, he is. He seems to be holding the line on spending, and that's kind of. I find that quite interesting in light of the poll of his own party, you know, in the legislature, particularly among progressives who are not all that happy with the governor's more cautious and conservative approach, actually, to spending these days.
And I read, Gary, I forget where it was. It might have been in the National Review or in the American Spectator, a right-leaning publication like that. But the gist of the article was a couple of months ago, hey, don't look now, but the governor of Connecticut, as liberal as he is on social issues, is all buddy-buddy with the Republican Party on fiscal issues.
He certainly is. Yes, yes, that's true. And I think that has proven to be somewhat of a surprise to many people, you know, particularly when Lamont started in statewide politics here, you know, challenging really conservative orthodoxy and the war in Iraq and so forth. But he seems to have, and I've watched him, you know, over time, he seems really to have moved closer and closer to the center of the spectrum, particularly, as you already noted, on economic fiscal issues. And and as a result of that, Republicans are getting along quite well with him, and elements of the Democratic Party are not, although there are some moderate Democrats who find him desirable, too. They like his positions, but there are a good number of, and the Democratic Party has moved increasingly to the left up there, that they're finding Lamont sort of distancing himself, if you will, from you know, the thrust of that party in the legislature.
Well, you know, Gary, and maybe, and you and I have followed elections for a long time, and I've worked on some campaigns, and you know, you sit around the table and you say, well, there are certain votes that we know we're going to get, and there are votes that we need to get. And I wonder, Gary, if Lamont, well, the more he got into this and said, you know, To get done what I want to get done, I think he's sincere about the fiscal health of the state. He ain't going to do it with left-leaning votes. He's got to get those centrist, even slightly conservative Democrats from Fairfield County and Litchfield County and all that.
That's right. And there is, and you're correct, there is a significant portion of Democrats that are, they are not, you know, far left at all, but and they are more towards the center, particularly, as you say, on fiscal issues. There is a decided, you know, progressive faction as well. We know that. And they're not too happy with the governor. But right now he seems to be building, I think, a pretty strong coalition, a working coalition of moderate Democrats. And a lot of Republicans like him. And, in fact, I had a conversation with the governor once, and he said, you know, I really like working with the Republicans. We seem to get along on a lot of issues, and I thought it was interesting for him to tell me that.
And let's not parse this. I mean, a lot of his friends, I mean, let's not forget, Gary, and you and I know this, but I remind people, Ned Lamont is a very rich man who got in early into the cable TV business and the construction business, cabling. So, you know, he lived and will live when he retires. He lives among some very rich people in Fairfield County. He doesn't want them going to the Carolinas and to Florida.
That's true. Yeah, he's, you know, and you have to look at, you know, what he, I mean, obviously inherited an enormous amount of money, but at the same time, he did make his own money as a businessman. You mentioned his cable TV program or business connected to college campuses. Mm-hmm. He made a fortune doing that, and I think he understands the role of free enterprise and business, and he appreciates that. And he is not, you know, coming out of, you know, if you will, sort of a civil rights left wing background as some of the Democrats up there are. He is clearly a businessman, and you already mentioned Fairfield County, and there are a lot of business people down there too that he's gotten to know, and that's where he has most of his friends in that circle. Yeah.
A couple of things I want to get to, Gary, before we wrap up. Number one, with the fourth round four, Ganim v. Gomes. Now we've surpassed Ali Frazier 1, 2, and 3. We're now at the level of Rocky IV. God rest his soul, Carl Weathers. Has this, and Gary, you might know, but I said this the other day, has this ever happened in American politics? I mean, usually, Gary, we see the weird story at the end of the news. Hey, it was some little jerkwater town, and a judge said, flip a coin, and the winner is the mayor.
I know.
Is there any indication this has ever happened before on this scale?
Paul, if there is, I do not know of it. Uh-huh. We've talked, you know, about this. I know we've had a primary, which, of course, was suspect. Then we had a general election. Perhaps it was suspect. Now we had another primary, and now we have another general coming. And I've never seen anything like this. And John Gomes says he's going to keep going right to the very end. And he does have a pretty strong base of support, and they're encouraging him to continue to challenge the mayor. It's probably, again, going to come down to those absentee ballots, and that's mm-hmm. where a lot of the questions are always raised in Bridgeport. But the good thing is that Stephanie Thomas, you know, the Secretary of the State, does have election monitors posted in Bridgeport. And I think that some of that, at least in the last contest, you know, has been supervised quite well. I hope that it continues. But no, I have never seen four elections to determine who a mayor is.
The big elephant in the room, Gary, the oral arguments today, 2 hours worth in the U.S. Supreme Court, lawyers for Donald Trump versus lawyers for Colorado, and the attorney for the group that posed this 14th Amendment thing. And I guess, Gary, the thing that came out today that was interesting is this argument over whether or not the president is actually an officer of the country, yes. and whether or not the 14th Amendment actually includes him or not.
Yeah, well, you know, Paul, I have the 14th Amendment right in front of me, and I see no mention of the president in Section 3. And, you know, and that's exactly the point that Justice Jackson was making, which I thought was very interesting, you know, a Democratic appointee, Biden appointee, really claiming that the president is not covered under the under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And other justices, too, were making that, you know, that that claim that or were questioning that. And so it's, yeah, as I read the, I mean, you would think if they really wanted to include the president, they would have. It does seem to me that when they talk about officers, they probably had more in mind cabinet officers or, mm-hmm. or people along those lines, you know, to keep Confederates out of the cabinet and to monitor that. But I think that Justice Jackson raised a really, really good point, and she kept hammering at that the 14th Amendment, Section 3, does not include the president. And furthermore, then, you know, this was a real interesting, as you mentioned, you know, oral argument today. And then, of course, Section 5 comes up, too, about who really enforces this, and that should be, according to the Constitution, the Congress, not a state Supreme Court, you know, that voted on this. And so I anticipate, as I know many are, others are too, that, and I think the court's going to make a ruling very soon, but I wouldn't be surprised if this is a unanimous reversal of the Colorado Supreme Court.
Wow. Yeah. Gary, finally, I had a listener called earlier and noting that looking back in history, we had Nikita Khrushchev, who appeared on American television to talk directly to the American people. I remember Mike Wallace when he interviewed one of the Ayatollahs during the Iranian, the fundamentalist revolution, other things like that. Osama bin Laden being interviewed on national TV. And I had a guy wanting me to ask you what your opinion was, Gary, on kind of this uneasiness that Tucker Carlson, I guess it's coming up tonight or in the next few days, is going to talk to Vladimir Putin. It won't be on a network. I guess it's on X. Should the American people hear from somebody like that? I mean, we have before. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, we do know that Vladimir Putin is a real menace in Europe, and he does pose, I think, a tremendous threat to European countries, not just Ukraine. And if Ukraine falls, I am absolutely convinced that he's going to keep moving. And that could bring us into a world war because of connections with NATO, you know, the NATO countries that we have. I know there's controversy about that. People are wondering why Carlson is doing that, but I think it could be instructive and informative. I don't really see a problem with that. I know that you know, Tucker Carlson can be really controversial in the things that he does, but I don't really know what the downside of that is to have an interview with let the people see who he is and hear him. And I kind of doubt that it's going to be flattering. You know, I would hope not. If it is, then I do have an issue with that. But yeah, I don't have a problem with somebody like Tucker Carlson interviewing you know, Putin, because I think it's good for the American people to see who this man really is. But of course, I'll be honest with you, I don't think you're going to learn a lot, because a guy like that operates in the shadows.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean? And he's probably aware, hey, there's an opportunity for people, you know, to think that I'm a good guy, but, which he is not. He's a mass murderer is what he is. And so, but I have no problem with Carlson doing that.
Sacred Heart University's political science professor, scholar in residence, Dr. Gary Rose. Gary, always good to chat with you. Take care, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you.
Okay, Paul. Yep.
Gary, be good. Thanks. All right. There you go. So, for the gentleman that called earlier, yeah, you're right. So let's hear from him. As that gentleman pointed out, Nikita Khrushchev spoke to a U.S. audience. No love he had for the U.S. back then. Mike Wallace, I distinctly remember that. I was a young kid, you know, 17 years old, 18, going, wow, Mike Wallace is talking to the Ayatollah. And, of course, the interview with Osama bin Laden. Okay, back to open phones in just a bit later on this hour. When we do that, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Let's get another analysis of what happened today, happened and maybe didn't happen, the questioning, some people looking at it from different angles. At the U.S. Supreme Court as to whether or not the state of Colorado or any state could pull Donald Trump off of the 2024 ballot by pointing to a section of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Our next guest is Assistant General Counsel and the Ed Meese III Legal Counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation, graduate of Lafayette College, Rutgers Law School. He is a veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom, retired Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve, and a former domestic policy analyst on Capitol Hill. Matt Forries joins us from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Matt, Paul here in Connecticut, good to have you on. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me, Paul.
So, Matt, give me your long and short view of this. It certainly sounds like even the left-leaning justices here may not have been impressed with the argument here. But what's your take?
Right. So the bottom line is it went very well for Trump today. So several liberal and conservative justices raised concern about the consequences of removing him from the ballot. And those generally are the potential disenfranchisement of millions of voters, the empowering of a single state to determine a national election, the likelihood that blue and red states go tit for tat and disqualify candidates, and then the haphazard nature of different states having different standards for evidence and proof in their disqualification trials.
So the questioning and the responses, Matt, very interesting, and I played some of those for my audience here before we chatted here this afternoon. And I guess an exchange that's getting a lot of replay here in the media world is won by the counsel that's representing this woman who brought the charges here, who it was funny to hear him going with Judge Gorsuch. He was one of Judge Gorsuch's law clerks. But the attorney going at it a little bit with Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson as to whether or not the president is even included in this.
Right. That was one of the big surprises of the argument. It's funny you highlight that. We came away very, very surprised by that. And now you're getting into the three big issues of whether or not the text of the 14th Amendment applies to Trump, whether the text allows the states to act on their own, and whether an insurrection occurred. So initially I was talking about the consequences, but This is really why they think that it may not apply to Trump. So that first issue is whether or not he's disqualified by the language of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And as you know, that amendment was passed in the wake of the Civil War to prevent insurrectionists from holding many public offices. And that breaks down. It can get a little textual and a little technical, but if you just give me a second,
sure.
I can try to summarize this. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you previously took an oath to support the Constitution as an officer of the United States and then engaged in insurrection, then as a consequence, you can't be a member of Congress or hold any office under the United States or under any state. Okay, so breaking that down, it applies to someone who took an oath as an officer of the United States. Now, this sounds very counterintuitive, but there's a very strong argument, which we would agree with. There's recent Supreme Court precedent that officer of the United States refers to appointed and not elected officials. And there's also textual arguments that you can make from other places of the Constitution where the phrase officer of the United States does not apply to the president. So It's the appointments clause the commissioning clause, where the president commissions officers, military officers, the impeachment clause. These are all referring to the president separately from officers of the United States. And Ketanji Brown Jackson, our newest justice, was actually really very heated on this point. The presidency is not explicitly mentioned as being a covered official or as an office that an oath-breaking insurrectionist would be prevented from taking. So it was also kind of surprising that one of the conservative justices, Amy Coney Barrett, seemed a little seemed like she was questioning that point. But ultimately, what the court seemed to be placing most of the emphasis was the second big issue, and that's whether or not the provisions of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment are self-executing. Mm-hmm. And I can describe that as that.
Yeah, sure, please.
Okay. So the term that gets bandied about is whether or not something, a provision of the Constitution, is self-executing. That means whether or not Congress needs to pass a separate statute to be able to allow a private party or a state to enforce its provisions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so like a lot of people know that when you're under the civil rights, if you are abused by a police officer, for instance, you can bring a Section 1983 claim. And so there's a separate statute that's allowed to give you a cause of action. Now, what the Supreme Court was really focused on today was the fact that it goes completely against the history of the Civil War and Reconstruction to think that they were intending to give states greater power over national elections, right? The 14th Amendment is all about curtailing state power in the wake of slavery and in the wake of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we're going to give like local, you know, state officials the ability to disqualify national elections just doesn't jive. The Chief Justice mentioned that, and several other justices kind of pointed that out. And then it's interesting is one of the last issues, and there are several more, but one of the last issues touched on just in this argument was whether or not Trump actually engaged in an insurrection. And that was almost an afterthought in the arguments, and it was barely covered. And that was brought up by Ketanji Brown Jackson.
So, Matt, the way this shakes out, is the Supreme Court, how could they rule on this? Because I heard today they can rule with an actual vote. They can just issue a majority opinion without getting into the weeds on who voted to who or for what. They can say something that would bounce it back to a lower court. What can the court do here? Not necessarily what would they do, but what can they do here?
Well, they have a lot of power to do all kinds of things. They could just take the very broad view. And what Trump supporters would like the most is if they said Trump is not even covered by this provision. 14th Amendment, Section 3 doesn't even apply to him as an officer of the United States. And there is a very interesting thing about Donald Trump is that he's almost a unicorn in American history. He had never taken an oath as a public official before he became president.
Hmm.
The only one you could point to, you know, unlike him is George Washington, perhaps John Adams. But like nearly every other president in our history has been something beforehand, a congressman, senator, governor, and so forth. So they've taken oaths described by Section 3. That would be the cleanest and best outcome for Trump. All right. Now, what it seems to be that what it seems like they will do, however, is rule on this self-executing provision. And unfortunately, Trump supporters can't breathe too easily here because this has the potential to come back and blow up on their faces in January 2025. Okay, if that's the basis of the ruling, and it's most likely it is, it's probably where most of the votes will come from. You could find – and that is essentially saying – states, you don't have the power to disqualify on this provision. Only Congress has the power. Well, guess what? That leaves as an open question, what can Congress do in the future? And so you could theoretically, Trump could win the Electoral College, and then a new Congress could decide that he was disqualified under this provision and then send us into total chaos.
Wow. Matt, thank you. Matt, I'll tell you, it's incredible how you folks in the legal profession, you're trying to figure out what the framers meant. I mean, as much of the word and the verbiage that's there, it is really a constant task of interpretation, isn't it?
It is. And I'd like to say just a general point in defense of my side. You know, we're the people who are the originalists and textualists, right? And this idea of approaching the Constitution and trying to get the original public meaning of the words, that was a real radical change from what the left had been doing in the Supreme Court for about 100 years, where they had been, you know, kind of taking a results-oriented approach, having words be flexible, looking to the purpose of a statute, the purpose of a constitutional provision, and then, like, making policy arguments. And they've criticized those of us who are conservatives, saying that originalism and textualism, you know, they're phony, they're fake. It doesn't lead to the correct interpretation. It is just a starting point, right? Mm-hmm. And we have people on the, you know, conservatives who disagree on whether or not this applies and whether or not President Trump is disqualified. So I think it's better to be bound by words. Words have meaning. And it can be a little dry and technical, and it may seem a little strange to non-lawyers to hear this kind of discussion, but there are compelling arguments that officer of the United States does not apply to the president and Donald Trump.
Interesting. Matt Forese, thank you. Landmark Legal Foundation. Check him out online, Landmark Legal Foundation. Matt, thanks, and we will check in down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Be good. Matt Forese there.